also terrible moments in time in our histories, how there's this potential in sound to connect viewers to the time and the place, sort of time travel, actually. And I was thinking about a conversation that you and I had about your mom, that you had a recording of your mom on voicemail on one of your phones.
Right.
And I was thinking about that almost as a gravestone, like this interesting sense that that audio is something you actually go back and revisit as a way to be closer and commune with your mom, who is no longer with you. So I guess to start the conversation, if you don't mind just telling me a little bit about your mom.
Of course.
And then also, you know, just some context or circumstance around her passing.
Yeah, so my mom, Sid McIntosh, passed away just over 11 years ago, and she died from colon cancer at 61. And she was just a really warm, kind of dorky, but in a sweet way, kind of person. She was a pediatrician and really, really smart, amazing diagnostician. And, you know, I always felt so proud of her. She would always get sort of dinged in her annual review for spending too long with patients, you know, and it was hurting the practice's bottom line because she would take, you know, 40 minutes instead of the 20 or the 15 or whatever. She had a great sense of humor. She loved movies, film, and she was a walker. So she...
Oh my God.
Her. Do you remember?
She was a really
fast walker. Yeah, she was definitely my rock, you know, the parent that I really leaned on and could turn to when I needed help. And she had composure through things that were really challenging that I admired.
Now, your daughter was alive when your mom was alive. They overlapped by, what, 3 years for you?
Not even, just under two. My mom was so excited when my daughter was born and loved being a grandma. Their relationship was really sweet. My mom wore lipstick every day, and, you know, it was like the first thing that she would do pretty much in the morning would be like brush her teeth and put on lipstick. I think she called it lippies. My daughter would come over and pout her lips out, and my mom would, you know, pretend to put lipstick on or maybe put some lipstick. I don't even know.
Yeah.
This isn't necessarily something that I would have maybe like loved putting lipstick on a toddler, but, you know, with my mom being sick, I think it was permitted.
And the bonding.
No, definitely. And she was so helpful to me, you know, when my daughter was little with things like, is this normal? You know, I could ask for her professional advice on things, which was really, and just, you know, it was so comforting. You know, something that I feel sad about is that I have another child and my sister has two children who never got to meet our mom. And, you know, I feel like they were really cheated out of having a great person in their lives.
And that's actually the perfect transition to this idea of how do we memorialize these people who were so alive in our lives, especially if we're trying to communicate to someone who wasn't there, right?
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about what ways you have memorialized.
Yeah, so my mom was cremated, and then her cremated remains were put into this garden behind the church that she attended, and it's a really pretty, it's a memorial garden, and there's a stone labyrinth in there, and beautiful plantings, and she's kind of right at the base of this iris, and that was one of her favorite flowers, and both my daughters went to preschool at this church, so that was really comforting for me. I just felt almost like my mom was, you know, watching them play or hearing them play, you know, sort of right on the other side of this garden wall. On Mother's Day, we'll go to the garden. My sister will come with her family, and we'll sit on the bench, and the kids will be, you know, running around playing, and sometimes we cry, sometimes we don't, but it's a nice kind of way to mark the day and sort of also just mark the passage of time.
It's interesting to me that you, just in this thing that you just said, you're talking about the sound of your kids and your mom being able to, like, listen over or overhear.
Right.
But even the idea of going to visit that space, any conversation is sort of like this audio exchange with someone who can't give it back to you, right? You can't return the favor.
Obviously, I don't know the mechanics of how that might work or not. Probably not, but it's comforting. Yeah, definitely.
So how did you, can you tell us a little bit about the audio that I was remembering?
I'm so glad you brought it up because it's been a couple of years since I listened to that. I have an old iPhone. It's about the size of an index card and like really thick. So if that gives you a visual, it's an old one. I actually inherited it from my mom after she died. I think it was her old phone, which is like an upgrade for me. So it's in this like very chunky, very protective pink rubber case. It's a funny object. But yeah, for a while, I really would now and then, like usually when I was feeling sad, you know, when I was really missing my mom, and oftentimes if it was like a time when I needed comfort or I wished that I could be comforted by my mom, I would have like a box of random cords and junk and stuff, and I would take this phone out and, you know, plug it in, and then you have to kind of wait for it to charge up. So there's kind of like the anticipation that's kind of building, right? And it's not like a send-off voicemail. It's like a, hey, I'm ready to be picked up. My appointment's over.
Wow.
Kind of things. Just hearing her voice would really bring me a lot of relief or, you know, it's soothing. I think the sound of, you know, someone you love's voice.
For sure.
I'm going to try to set it up after we talk so I can listen to it again. Now that we've been talking, I'm like, okay, yeah, the voicemail on the old phone. We went to San Francisco together, and it was about 2 months before she died. And I was just thinking about that trip a couple of days ago. This was sort of before her hospice care had really started. You know, I think she had a sense that her time was short. And my mom was, you know, not using a wheelchair, but in the airport, you know, was in the wheelchair with assistance, and she was on oxygen. So we had her oxygen tank. Anyway, I've always felt sort of funny about that trip. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe also too, because we came home and it was sort of maybe a day or two later, it was the doctor's appointment where the doctor was like, yep, I think we've kind of hit the end of the road in terms of treatment, and, you know, we'll be setting up, you know, hospice care. I will confirm that, but I'm pretty sure one of the messages on the phone is from when we were there.
You're sort of recreating her each time.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
Recreating and kind of almost like reshaping, I think, too, like depending on what I need, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It's almost witchcraft.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I love that. I think that's something really interesting. I'm also really a little bit curious whether you've ever thought about having this audio protected or like re-recorded or something
saved
saved in a more formal way. And similarly, like, why haven't you done this? But then
I know it's like, right. It's like a precious thing that's like on a phone that might not turn on anymore. Like, right. Cause that happens.
But then also thinking about whether formalizing in that way, this thing that is so mundane and personal and daily.
Right.
Or this thing that marks such like a tender time. Whether the formalization of that removes some of the humanity of it.
And I think, too, I think there is something about the audio being on a phone. It does give me that moment of, like, I can just pick up the phone and hear my mom's voice. Or I can pick up the phone and call her.
Yeah.
She just left me this message. Let me listen to it. You know, like, there's, like, a comfort. And the audio, I guess, I don't know, maybe because I don't listen to it that often, it feels special each time or feels new or something.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting too. I didn't even think about the idea of being able to replay sound being like duplication when you make copies of copies of copies, something, you know.
Yeah.
Things lose their integrity.
Degrade, yeah.
Really interesting. Emily, thank you so much for this
conversation. I do like talking about her, so it's thank you. Thanks for giving me the opportunity.
Yeah, but thank you again. Yeah.
I love you.
Love you too.
Hi, Morg. It's so I charged the phone and it turns out that I have 66 voicemails on here from my mom that I saved. The most recent one was on February 15th, 2014, to I guess when I got the phone, which was October 18th, 2012. And there were even some on here that I had never played. Most of them were her telling me that she was running into the store and did I need anything or do I have any corn chips at home? She forgot to get them at the store. Can I call her back? Little things like that. So, but here's the one that was the last one that I got from her. So I was going to play it.
Hi, sweetie. It's me. Sorry, didn't pick up fast enough. I assume you're on your way. So, maybe you can give me a call when you get settled. Bye.
You are listening to Is Sound a Language?
Annie Chen.
Can you tell me a ghost story?
Ghost story. 我要想想看有没有...
Dad, you also have ghost stories too.
Hmm?
你不是有鬼故事吗?
不要照顾这些事情, okay? Chinese way. When the girl died before 18, without married, she cannot go to final peace place. So his mother's sister died before 18, passed away. So his father was requested by his mother's mother, grandma, asked for to marry his mother's sister. So his father rejected. He doesn't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then one night, daddy went in, when he was seven, he mm-hmm. went into his auntie's house, room. Because they're Chinese, four corner, the mm-hmm. house. The elder son lived on the east side. The second son lived on the west side. Parent lived in the center. But he is, for fun, he went to his uncle, aunt's side. So his father, mother cannot find him. Then he can. Your father cannot breathe. 7 years old. Mm-hmm. Because the little girl, mm-hmm. the one passed before 18,
mm-hmm.
the auntie choked his neck. He said, "Somebody choked my neck." And she said, "My father should marry her. Otherwise, she cannot be peace." You know.
Mm-hmm.
So they finally agreed to marry his. Late aunt.
Mm-hmm.
Then that's the first story. I think he attracts.
But that's like 鬼压床.
No, it's not paralysis? A 鬼压床. He's not asleep.
Oh.
He stand up in that room, play.
Okay.
Then the second story is when your father went to Britain to study his PhD in law.
Mm-hmm.
One time he went to a hotel. He usually call your me, your mother, about the whole trip.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, strange, when I went to register in the school, because they are their hotel, because he came in late.
Mm-hmm.
So they assigned him to the other hotel. But the administration office lady said, that hotel is not safe. Nobody's living in that hotel. But he no place. They asked your father, say, can you live there? Your father said, no problem. So he went in. Then when he went to bed, he turned off the light, then he fell asleep, then suddenly he hear two girls talking from the center of the room. Then one, go, 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 go. The other one said, ha, ha, ha. Then he suddenly jump out of the bed, turn on the light, bring his shoes and the Bible beside his bed. And he fell asleep. And he told me the whole floor has no one. In that floor. But next day he's peace and safe. So then he decided to come back home here. The next year when he went back to the hotel,
mm-hmm.
he asked him why, because he registered to come back.
Mm-hmm.
He asked the people there, he said, I can go to an original hotel, they don't have space. He said the hotel shut it down. Then daddy get very sick mm-hmm. after he back from London. Remember? He's mm-hmm. sick for a long time. That's the second ghost story. The third ghost story, his mother told me, he went to South Asian country. Mm. Then he seriously sick. The master, you know, the Buddha master say, somebody follow him to come back to Taiwan. Mm-hmm. So they did a lot of, you know, procedural, like a...
exorcism?
Exorcism.
How did they do it?
I don't know. He told me that. Oh. His grandma paid, your grandma paid a huge money to carry that.
Did it work?
I don't know. The last one is we move into the house, nice one string cord, and daddy liked the house very much. And I don't. You know, your mother has a big courage. Mm-hmm. So what I did when we bought the house, when daddy went to London study, me and Lisa, your elder sister, I always go into the house and cook the food and immediately go to our master bedroom. Didn't come out. Then he got more sick. Then I have somebody coming to check the house. And they say they have a dead baby buried underground. So I decide.
Did they find it?
No, they didn't.
What?
I just the people, okay, fortune teller people. He from New York, famous one. I pay big bucks for him to stop by. He immediately say that. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know we have problem or not. I just want to see the house is good or not. I think this is a brand new house. We just bought it. Not a brand new, actually. People lived there for 2 years. And they divorced. So I moved in. Daddy got sick. Then I sold the house to another lady, no husband, divorced already. I say, but surely divorced. Should be safe, sell to her. She owned a shop in the Lake Forest Mall. And after 2 years, I heard the shop was closed. So that means the house is no good.
Yeah. How come? Because it sounds like dad had a lot of ghosts.
Because some people can see it, some people can feel. I'm very strong, so I don't see things like that.
Yeah, but it sounds like throughout his life, you guys got a lot of masters and fortune tellers to, but whenever I had mental health issues, you guys didn't even think to consult?
No, I don't think it's even I told you don't go to the cemetery,
yeah,
right? I'm not the one consult, his mother is the one. You know, so I don't know how to get anybody. When I go into the with the master, it's because we have some kind of practice to help to comfort the dead or comfort the people sick. So I just go along with them. And the master told us, I didn't seek for anything. Okay, but his mother seek for something. John Lisa doesn't pregnant. So his mother go find somebody to see her. And the master say, Lisa has no problem to have baby. I just need to wait her time.
Okay.
Same when we were sick. Remember I bring the master to see you? He say, same thing. Oh, you don't have a big problem. Just need to wait your time out. And when he's sick, daddy's sick, I show the master. The master say, he's no problem. Just, you know, once a period, you will have a deep, but he will not have trouble. So, but I never really sick for anything. Just somebody think that she's sick, so they want us to see the master. Your grandma actually is the one initial most. Because she is the Buddhist practice, so they believe that. I don't believe. I live in USA, I have nobody. You know? That's why I remember the few strange things.
There is another one that you told me. It was right after your dad's funeral.
Oh, this is a long time ago. My father passed away, okay? Then one night, my elder sister, she is not my father's daughter, it's my mother's previous husband's daughter. And she said the curtain on fire. Because we have big fight, argue about the cremate. My mother doesn't like the cremate. She says it's too much pain. But you know, cremate is cheaper. We bury the whole body, it's very expensive. My father passed when only 20 years old. He only saved some money for us to live comfortable. if we spend a huge money in the hospital or the burial, then we don't have the money to live until we grow up. So, but my mother doesn't want it. She's so mad. She said, how could you guys so not pity on your father pass away? You know, then suddenly my mother's room door slammed. It's a hot summer, no wind.
Mm-hmm.
Door slammed, just like my father used to do. And Chinese say first 7 days, the dead didn't go away. They are around. Okay, so we all become quiet. No one say anything.
Mm-hmm.
And after like three, five minutes, my cousin, because we are very young, I'm only 20. My elder sister probably, but she's not my father's daughter, so she cannot say anything. And my brother only 1 year older than me, so my mother's brother's daughter come to our house taking care of the whole business. So she said, okay, we need to decide. We don't decide now, okay? Cool down for a while, then we come back later. That night, my sister had that dream. I don't understand why my father didn't show us, my mother or me, because I'm the one actually do all the work.
Mm-hmm.
Then I realized he doesn't want to scare us, because my sister is not his daughter,
right.
So he probably think that she would not scare. So my mother agreed afterwards.
Oh, so the curtains on fire was a dream, and so she was saying that. That was him saying that he agrees to be cremated.
Yes, he wanted the cremation. He actually told me that before he passed away. He told me, don't waste money on me. He doesn't want to even cure, because you know, kidney failure can do the dialysis, but too expensive. Each one probably costs $1 million. We don't have that much money. So he doesn't want to do it. He said, don't waste money in the burial, okay? Just cremate. But my mother doesn't want to listen, because she says too much pain, too painful. So that's why we had a bigger fight. But it turned out he agreed. So we put his ashes in the temple. You know, Chinese will put in temple or bury on the ground. When my mother passed away, we moved my father to the ground.
Okay.
With my mother.
She wasn't cremated.
She cremated.
Oh, she was too.
But that time, it's 20 years later. Cremate is the only way.
Oh, no really?
Other way. Yeah. Because we don't have enough space in Taiwan.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she agreed.
Okay.
Yeah. She not really agree, but she kind of agreed. Because she already dementia. What do you call that?
Dementia.
Yeah, dementia. So she doesn't really know what. Then we just do it.
Mm-hmm.
You are listening to Is Sound a Language?
Alina Akbarhan. Ocean's West Skies is a poem by Nicholas Wong, written in 1993. Complete all blanks on the behalf of the light, so much so that it can't do, it can't narrate. A love story without drinking. You down without revealing the bite marks on a hand against the shadows. Consent without outlining the emptiness of the pillion behind you, the one. You believe? Steering always to a better place. But time is famous, and it's pointless to be radical like a coriander. Once time carried you to a book, then a body, and you knew there's repulsion in both. Once it carried you first to hands you'd bite, when they made you present like the nowness of the news, then to those that cast you away like a satellite. When yours, little by little, have learned the need to let loose, and not all water exists for boiling. Some space is forever so young that it puts you in the habit of punishing yourself, like smelling in the mall the skin of twins who mix perfume samples with youth that works and wrecks.
You are listening to Is Sound a Language?
Hello, my name is Ashley. I am a first year MFA student. So this week I've been thinking a lot about our previous conversation in class last week when towards the end of class we discussed ideas we had for this week, specifically towards the topic of ambiance. And when it was coming to my turn to talk about what would I potentially record, as usual, I had no idea. But I've been thinking a lot about that since. I have been thinking a lot about my relationship to sound, my relationship to noise, and what that means within the context of ambiance. I think my relationship to ambiance has actually changed a lot and drastically as I've gotten older, is what I'm realizing. I, more recently, and what I explained in last week's discussion, have needed to wear headphones in a lot of times throughout the day. Headphones on my commute trips to and from campus, school, work, wherever I'm going, whether that's the grocery store, anywhere, I've needed headphones just to kind of drown out the noise of a bus, you know, people screaming and talking, and wind sometimes, and recently the cold when it's been very cold. But I've also been thinking about my relationship to ambient sound and sleeping and trying to find a middle ground between complete silence but also an awareness of the world around me enough for me to, you know, potentially wake up if I need to, because I do think that is important, awareness. And so I've been thinking a lot about that. I've also, on a personal note, have been dealing with insomnia for this past week, which, if you know anything about sleep, not getting enough sleep, not getting any sleep, severely affects your health, and it affects your mental health, which I feel like I've been dealing with for the past few days, of like just feeling extreme exhaustion because I'm not getting enough sleep. And I'm trying to pinpoint the specificity of why I'm not getting enough sleep. Is it, you know, just, you know, natural stressors from school? There's a lot on our plate as MFA students. I feel like this semester there's a lot more meetings than we had in the fall semester, so maybe that's that. You know, personal life things have also come up. Yeah, just life being on this planet, it's tough for everybody. So, and I feel like too, there's an awareness of it being tough for everybody right now. I feel like I look at people's faces and they are tired and they are drained. And I feel like it's affecting me in a way, looking at other people and, you know, not seeing people being inspired too. So that's something that I've been thinking about. And so for this recording, I thought it would be interesting, you know, as I'm trying to navigate insomnia and as I'm trying to navigate, trying to get some decent rest over these past few days, I've been trying to like turn off electronics, you know, not have the TV on, not have music on, not have my headphones on, which I tend to do because that helps me fall asleep. I mentioned that last discussion where we talked about how I listen to binaural beats and I listen to white noise, and that kind of helps me calm my mind down, which really to me I think is the root of the problem. My mind is thinking about 12 million different things and is just having a hard time not thinking. So yeah, I decided to record me attempting to take a nap in silence, but turns out you're never really in silence, especially if you have the window wide open. I actually had to have the window wide open because our apartment and the plethora of issues that we have to deal with, the heating has been blasting even though it's super warm outside. So we've had to keep our windows pretty open just so we can get some air circulation and just so that the, you know, we're not dying of overheat. So I attempted to just turn off all electronics, not even have my headphones on, and just to try to sit in darkness, and try to, yeah, just sit there and close my eyes and see what that does. But like I said, turns out that we're never really in silence. And what it actually did is it made me pay attention to what was happening outside, which is kids playing across the street, buses coming through, cars coming through in and out of the street above us, or not above us, across from us, excuse me. And just, yeah, the natural sound of life, which actually made me want to pay more attention to that. So it wasn't a disturbance. The ambiance wasn't a disturbance to me, but it just made me want to pay more attention to it. So I don't know if it was a successful attempt on trying to get some sleep, but it made me consider how there is no such thing really as silence unless you specifically design like some type of chamber that completely blocks out all different types of noise. It also made me consider how there's never any silence even when I have my headphones on and don't have music. There's like always this like electric static sound that's going in between the ears, and how maybe we've become desensitized to that sound. We've become desensitized to electricity, but sound and ambiance and life and the sound of life is always around us. So these are the sounds of the outside world of my apartment.
You are listening to Is Sound a Language?
My name is Logan Larson.
Thank you.
You are listening to Is Sound a Language on WRCT Pittsburgh, produced by the students in Contextual Practice Seminar. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily express those of WRCT Pittsburgh or its members.
When Trump started issuing his executive orders, I saw universities start scrubbing their language. Without being asked, I saw universities start deleting environmental justice. First off, I was pretty proud, actually, that as a movement, we've gotten to a place where there is a president trying to erase us from history. I don't want to carrot my way into compliance with people who are trying to kill us, because in our neighborhood, it's very clear the industry wants to kill us, right? They put toxic chemicals, they put arsenic, mercury, dioxin into the air. That means they don't care about the kids who have to grow up in that neighborhood. That is not negotiable for me.
That's Maria Lopez Nunez, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Maria Lopez Nunez on environmental justice. Parts of the United States are an eco-disaster, a sacrifice zone. Take parts of Newark, New Jersey. If you travel down a one-mile stretch of Doremus Avenue in Newark, you pass a natural gas plant next to a sewage treatment facility, next to an animal fat rendering plant, next to a series of ominous-looking chemical storage containers behind acres of fencing. Airplanes pass overhead every 2 minutes, their engines rattling windows, while a putrid smell wafts from the open pools at the sewage treatment plant. Nationally, where are these polluters located? Overwhelmingly in poor communities of color, like the Ironbound section of Newark, where activists are organizing and fighting back to create a just, vibrant, and sustainable community. Our guest today is Maria Lopez Nunez. She's deputy director of the Ironbound Community Corporation in Newark. She's an environmental justice organizer and plays a large role in activating and uplifting her community, while also pushing for policies to address environmental injustice locally, regionally, and nationally. She spoke at the Environmental Law Conference at the University of Oregon in Eugene in March.
Hi, everybody. I'm Maria Lopez Nunez. Happy to be here in Eugene, Oregon. I'm from Newark. Well, I'm from Honduras. I was born in Central America. Most of my life, I grew up with people not knowing where that country was, actually, until Trump put us on the map his first time as a whole country. So, you know, very excited. Haven't traveled the country much except to visit other environmental justice communities. So, of course, community, I'll tell you about mine first, the community I've served for the last 10 years under Ironbound Community Corporation, and that's in Newark, New Jersey. So Ironbound is a 4-square-mile neighborhood, right? Just 4 square miles in the city of Newark. Most people fly to Newark to go to New York. Actually, when you land in Newark Airport, they tell you you've arrived in New York, but you're in a different state. You're actually across the river in New Jersey, Newark, New Jersey. And Newark, New Jersey is home to the longest Superfund site in the country. That's 17 miles of a Superfund site. That's our Passaic River. The river surrounds us on two sides. It's a Superfund site because during the Vietnam War, we were the largest producers of Agent Orange. You know, Diamond Alkali, the producers of Agent Orange, had plants along the riverbank. They knew at the time that they had other ways to produce Agent Orange, but they chose to do it in the most toxic way. I guess if you're going to use it to poison people overseas, who cares if you poison some people at home, right? No need to do safety. So they were dumping the byproduct dioxin being, you know, one of the most cancer-causing things to human beings, straight into the river. I've talked to many workers that have now rare skin disease, they talk a lot about the white dust that covered everything in the plant. And that white dust would get on the truck wheels and then be wheeled all across the neighborhood. So I used to have colleagues that would swim. You know, there was a swimming pool in the neighborhood at the time. The swimming pool had dioxin in it, eventually having to be closed. There's actually some iconic pictures of neighborhood residents sitting, you know, on their stoop, on their porch. And these people from EPA, newly formed EPA, they're in toxic hazmat outfits, right? Looking like they're astronauts, and people freaking out because they're in T-shirts, right? So we start seeing the divide of the community versus the experts pretty quick in the neighborhood of Ironbound. So the longest Superfund site in the country. It has over 100 brownfield sites in that 4 square miles. We are also host to the largest garbage incinerator in the state of New Jersey and in the region, and the largest sewage waste treatment facility. The sewage waste treatment facility would deal with the waste of 12 different states. So they would barge in waste into the neighborhood to be dealt with at PVSC. It's called the Passaic Valley Sewage Commission. I need y'all to understand what that smells like, right? That when you're dealing with the waste of 12 different states of over 4 million households, obviously that's not the people that live in our neighborhood. That's not even the people that live in our city. We were responsible for the waste, the human waste of 30 different municipalities. So, you know, I like to say, people don't think about things, right? You flush the toilet. Do you give it a second thought? Maybe if you don't feel good. I've had the pleasure to have to think about waste a lot. Waste of what happens when you throw something out. I should have started by saying I don't believe in recycling, right? And I hope no one here does too. It's a sham by the fossil fuel industry. And in our neighborhood, we really got to see that plastic buildup, how plastic was changing the waste composition and changing what the incinerator was looking like, because plastic's not good for them either. It's too light. It burns too fast. It was making their process really out of control. So they had over 700 violations. I believe firmly that's because they were in a black and brown community, because there are incinerators, comparable incinerators, that would only have 40 violations in the same time period. So when we're talking about 40 to 700, that's an exponential increase that you see in a city like Newark. What I say about our city is we're not a poor city. You know, I hate a lot of environmental justice. It's often this conversation of pity, of, you know, we need to have empathy and sympathy for people that are in bad conditions. I saw it as a story of theft, right? Of theft of our resources and our human potential. Most of the people making billions of dollars off of our city's resources and land, they didn't live in our neighborhood. They didn't even live in our city or even close by. So Superfund site, the largest incinerator, the largest sewage waste treatment facility on the East Coast. And then we were also home to the largest port on the East Coast, right? The Port of Newark and Elizabeth is where 80% of the consumer goods in the Northeast come through on, you know, these huge ships from Asia so that we can all purchase all our crap, right? So when I think about that, when I think about everything from the dollar store to Fifth Avenue coming through our neighborhood, I think of all the money that just runs by my neighborhood. So it was interesting to be part of an administration that was trying to change that through Justice 40, right? So for those of you that don't know, Justice 40 was an attempt, a guidance, if you will. I've learned the difference between mandatory and guidance, right? But a guidance that 40% of our resources should go to 40% of the population that is of color, that is marginalized, low-income, neglected communities. Look, I'm not a linear thinker, so you're going to have to come with me on this journey. I hope I won't bore you. That is one of my rules for organizing. Don't be boring. And I would say most of the environmental field, it can be kind of boring. It can be kind of boring to listen to. You glaze over and community members stop listening to the organizer at the front of the room, because our strategy for too long has been to shock and awe people, to make them afraid, right? In our small neighborhood, our organizing revolved around being friends with people. Very revolutionary. Making your neighbors your friends, you know, making it so that your neighbors want to hang out with you, that not every time that you're knocking on their door are you coming to them with a problem to solve, of like, you know, there's another thing coming into our neighborhood. So biggest, longest Superfund site, the garbage incinerator, the port of Newark and Elizabeth. And then we had, we were home to 3 power plants. And as of today, we are about to be home to 4 power plants in a 4-square-mile neighborhood. So when I think about that, you know, I think about what our neighborhood looks like. You would say it's mostly industry and then a little bit of people squeezed in there. And how I think I started making my mark in environmental justice is just because right place, right time. Anybody from a community could end up on a national circuit or being appointed to the White House. I think it's because, you know, as we partnered with lawyers and academics, it was so important to fight for our space as the community voice. I mean, you have no idea the insecurity to have to speak to a public interest law, you know, environmental law conference to say, well, I don't even have an advanced degree. You know, I do organizing and I've been at the White House quoted as saying regular ass people. Like, that's who we need to fill these rooms with, not just have rooms that are exclusively of lawyers or exclusively of academics. You know, while I was helping serve under the Biden administration, I was seeing that the rooms were too exclusive. You know, it was filled with professional advocates, quite frankly. Where do we have the real reflection of, like, who is in the room with us? Are there people that we don't know? Are there people that don't look like us and that have different life circumstances? Because if they're missing from the rooms, we're kidding.